Dons fans. It's been a much more enjoyable week this week than last, with the Bombers back on the winners list following our Friday night footy 29-point victory over the Western Bulldogs. The focus now turns to the opportunity to win two in a row for the first time in 2024. I'm Jonathan Walsh, and Ian Hume joins me in the Don the Stats studio to preview our round six clash against the Adelaide Crows. Hume, welcome, mate, and how's things?
Oh, look, everything's so much better the week after a win, especially one as good as that one against a team that's had the wilderness. I've had a spring in my step since Friday night and really looking forward to get stuck into what happened then that allowed us to win and looking at our upcoming challenge against the Crows. How about yourself?
Yeah, much like you, mate. Yeah, going well. Life's always, yeah, as you said, a little bit more enjoyable when your footy team wins, which is mad when you say it out loud, isn't it? But yeah, we're all passionate and love our Bombers. So yeah, the world's just a better place when we're up and about.
And as always, we like to start by thanking our new Patreon members for this week. And this week it's Christopher Bond, Savio Roy, Enzo Turpentine, Jamie Chirkop, Ben Gurens, and Daniel Stubbs. Once again, thanks for your ongoing support to the Don the Stat community and for every one of our patrons. We really appreciate all that you do to support us. And you've actually put out another medical room episode this week with Pat the Physio. And again, that's been really well received. So thanks, Pat, for joining you for that. And thanks for spending some time on your Wednesday to put that together.
Yeah, I don't think the physio is his surname, but no. Yeah, no, I've learned a lot. I know very, very little about the machinations of the human body and the things that footballers put themselves through and the process it takes to recover from some of those injuries. So, yeah, I've learned a lot in the two episodes. It was good to spend another half an hour with Pat on yesterday, on Wednesday, to chat through that. So, yeah, and it's getting some good feedback. And, yeah, the Don the Stat community keeps growing, doesn't it? And, yeah, it's good to see and continues to be a lot of fun. Speaking of fun, mate, the secret's out. We've got a live event coming up.
Yeah, we hinted at this a couple of weeks ago, and the announcement was on Monday. And so if you listen to other Essendon podcasts or you've seen our socials, it's not much of a surprise, but we're very lucky to have been invited to be part of a group of Essendon podcasts that are putting together a live event. So John and myself will be joining Scott and Grant from the Lunchtime Catch-Up podcast and Todd and Jasper from the Flight Plan for an event before the GWS game in round 9 on May 11th. So it's going to be a fun afternoon with each pod having their own segment before coming together for a big final session together. We're organising a lot of prizes and competitions for the day, as well as drinks being available at bar prices and food available as well. So the location is the Hightail Bar, and that's only 5 minutes walk from Marvel. So it's a perfect location to have this event before the GWS game. Doors for the event will open at 1 p.m. with the show starting at 2 p.m. and going all the way to 4 p.m., which leaves plenty of time to get to the stadium for the bounce at 4:35. Tickets are only $15 a head, and under 12s are able to attend for free. It is a family-friendly event. You can buy tickets through Intix, and we'll have a link to the tickets in the description of this episode. So follow that and get those tickets. I really can't wait for this, Jono. The tickets are already selling really well, and I'm super excited to see what the other podcasts put together, as well as just to meet so many Bombers fans and put some faces to names.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it as well, mate. Yeah, Don's fans are spoiled for lots of independent fan-driven content. There's some great, you know, podcasts out there, some great blogs and a whole range of different things that, yeah, Don's fans can go and enjoy and absorb, and we play one small part of that, and it's great to team up with a couple of others of the community and put a show on. So, yeah, it should be lots of fun, and hopefully, yeah, the Bombers are flying leading into that game, and then we can get along to Marvel and enjoy what comes afterwards. The other way to buy tickets, if it's easier, is just donthestat.com. There's a link up there. But yeah, 1 week at a time, mate. Maybe we go backwards before we go forwards. Shall we chat through the game last Friday night?
Yeah, look, I think going into that Bulldogs game, we were obviously hoping for at least some sort of response following the collapse we had against the Power. I wasn't overly confident going into the match, given our history against the Dogs, but fair to say that the club and the players really showed that it was the Port game that was the anomaly, not the promising signs of the first three games. And they put together one of the best four-quarter performances by the Dons in recent memories. If the replay of that game was a drink, then my attitude this week was,
just took it to my veins!
Look, let's start with the battle in the midfield. We spoke about the importance of the centre bounce given our game style and coming off being shellacked in the middle against Port. We highlighted how effective Liberatore was to the Dogs, particularly historically against us. So looking at him to start with, he still had 10 clearances and 25 disposals for the game, but he was being worn closely by Caldwell, which limited his impact somewhat. And the other player that got the most praise following the game was Sam Durham, who stood next to Bontempelli and really worked him over. So historically, Bontempelli has his lowest average possessions against Essendon, which is around 21, which probably does surprise a few people hearing that. But even then, he was limited to only 17 on the night, and then only 5 of those came in the second half. Only 4 of his 17 possessions contributed to a score, so really ineffectual compared to his usual output, even if Essendon is a team he historically hasn't got high levels of disposals against. You mentioned it in the preview last week, and it really stood out to me watching the game live, is just how reliant the Dogs are on those midfielders in Bont, Libra, and Treloar, and they don't really have the same depth that they had in previous years. You look at the rest of the supporting cast, so you've got Riley Sanders, who's young and he's getting subbed out of games and throwing the toys out of the cot as he's doing so. Jack McRae is on the outer and is not really playing that as critical a role to them or as crucial a role for them. Bailey Smith, who probably would be in the side, is injured. And then Caleb Daniel, who has spent some time in the middle, has been dropped and he's not playing tonight as we record now. So it really showed by the end of the game in that last quarter, we were able to run over the top of them with our extra rotations and extra midfielders, and we ended up winning 6 of the last 8 centre bounces. We showed we were well on top in that crucial area of the game.
Yeah, Sanders is going to throw the toys out of the cot early tonight because he's started as their sub against the Saints. But yeah, we won centre clearances 16-10 overall. As you said, we really dominated the last part of the game in that regard. Stoppage clearances were tied at 18 apiece. But scores from centre clearances were 19-6 in our favour, and stoppage scores 19-16 in our favour. So we certainly won the midfield battle. I did think that our hopes laid with being able to reduce the Libba influence, and I think we did that. As you mentioned, he's still got a lot of clearances, but we were able to really limit the effect of those. And then Durham's job on Bontempelli was something else. I've been really impressed with Sam Durham, as I think every Essendon fan has been this season. But I have to admit, I didn't see that coming. His ability to lock down and beat Bontempelli to the ball, Quali's influence, and then have an influence himself was outstanding. I'm just going to take the following straight. Those that sort of engage and follow us on Twitter will be pretty familiar with the work of Anth Proc and his website, The Bombers Blog. He summed it up best, so I'm just going to quote him verbatim. Using AFL player ratings, a measurement system used to assess a player's impact on the game, Bontempelli's rating of 10.9 was his lowest since the 2021 grand final. This match also marked just the 5th occasion since 2021 where he had 17 or fewer disposals, and only the 2nd time with just 2 inside 50s. Additionally, he's only recorded less than 180 metres gained 9 times throughout his career, with this occurring just once since round 5 in 2020. So, Durham just took him right out of the game and eliminated his influence, and it was something to behold.
Yeah, Anth put it really well there, and he does really great work. And he was on the show early last year, and he's really gone from strength to strength with the work that he's doing, especially with launching the Bombers blog this year. And I'll include a link to the blog in the description of this episode so you can check it out for yourself. He does match reviews and match previews that are really in-depth. And if you like what we do, you'll like what he does on his blog as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to touch on Jai Caldwell and his contribution too, mate. I think we're starting to see the signs of the player that he can be. I think he's teased us at periods in the past. The past 3 weeks, he's averaged 23 disposals, 6 tackles, 4 and a bit inside 50s and 3 clearances. He's building nicely. And what he did on Friday night to get involved in the transition, he wasn't necessarily able to stop Libba from getting clearance, but that's a really, really tough thing to do. But what he did do was make Libba work really, really hard around the ground and got involved in our link-up play. He took a career-high 10 marks. So, I think he's building really, really nicely.
Yeah, and something else I noticed with the centre bounce, particularly when I went back and rewatched it to do the centre bounce tracking that I post each week on the Patreon, I think we really set up a lot differently to the way we did in the Port game. So just for listeners, if you imagine that where the ball it bounces the middle of a compass, and then you have north as the side that's towards our goal, south is towards the opposition goal, and then east and west are the wings. We seem to set up much more southwest-east as opposed to north-south And then East and West. And so what that did in my mind was it was a much more defensive setup and blocked a lot of the lanes that the opposition can use to break out of the stoppage situation at the front. If you think about the way we set up against Port, there was often a pathway that was really easy for Horne Francis and Rosie to burst through. Whereas against the Dogs, we set up in a way that really blocked those lanes as much. And even when the Bulldogs did win the center clearance, as you sort of hit on before in terms of their players' effectiveness and the amount they scored from the center clearance, they really weren't that effective there. Now, it's the only reason that we were able to limit the effectiveness of the center bounce. So they obviously still had to win the contest against the opponent. But when we did lose it, it took a lot longer for the Dogs to get it into their forward line. They had to sort of go around where our players were. And that meant we were in a much better position to defend their entries from center clearance.
Yeah, against Port, it was really boom or bust, wasn't it? And unfortunately for us, it was a lot more bust than it was boom. I think we starting positions were adjusted. We got more out of our ruckman, didn't we? You know, we talked about that last week that they let themselves down against Port. They were much more influential against Tim English and Sam Darcy. I think we also just simplifies things. We just used the four primary mids throughout the match. You and I have been big on rotating more, but it needs to be balanced. And then we just added Stringer for 1 to 2 centre bounces a quarter to give the Dogs something else to look at, and then also just to give our other mids a bit more of a breather. So it was a lot more settled and balanced than the week before. We got that right blend of defence and attack. And we were reactive to the ball rather than the opposition. So we switched really quickly from a neutral situation into defence if needed, or into an attacking situation if that opened up as well. Whereas I thought last week we were just reactive to what Port Adelaide were doing. We were sort of watching the man rather than the ball. And you're right, when we lost the clearance, there was a lot more pressure. The Dogs went inside 50 from 8 of their 10 centre clearance wins, but they scored once and 5 of them resulted in direct turnovers. So there weren't a lot of really quick, fast, effective exits from the centre of the ground, which was, really good to see.
Yeah, and just touching on defensive aspects around the rest of the ground, our defensive structure has really held up so much better. And I think we've talked about the way we clearly want to play, which is by locking the ball into the forward half. And if you look at sort of that period in the third quarter, towards the back half of that quarter, we had 8 repeat inside 50 entries. And I think you can probably quibble a little bit if you're looking for areas for improvement. You know, for that period of dominance, we only scored 1 goal, 2 behinds from that. But what that did was it really set the stage for what would come in the final quarter. And we were able to take the confidence from executing the game plan that we've been working on all preseason and turned it into a period of match dominance that we really haven't demonstrated against a decent opponent for quite some time. Did you notice anything different about the way we executed our game plan this week? And what were the reasons why it was able to work this week? Was it something as simple as winning more centre bounces, or was there more to it?
Well, I certainly think that helped, mate. You can't be a forward half team if your midfield's getting well beaten, and you know that's what happened 2 weeks ago. A forward half game really only works if you're getting territory, and the best way to do that, it's not the only way. You can of course intercept in your defensive 50 and then take the ball forward from there. But the best way to do it is the shortest path, right? And that's to win the contest and win clearance. And we were so much better in that regard, or that part of the game. There were some moments early in the game where we gave the ball away and some bits in quarter two where we did it as well. But by and large, I thought our ball retention was a lot better. 66 was the fewest turnovers we've conceded since round one, and 3 was the fewest turnovers we've had in our own defensive 50 since round one as well. So, just the 3 times in our own D50 we gave the ball back directly to the opposition. And that had been a much bigger problem for us in previous weeks. We had over 100 marks for the game, which has become a bit of a KPI for us, I reckon. We only lost 3 games last season where we took 100 marks or more. We've won both times that we've taken 100-plus this year. Against Hawthorn, we didn't quite get there. It was 92. And then in our 2 losses, the opposition restricted us to 71 and 84. So our ability to control the ball, it really is a bit of a KPI, and we do that through kick mark. We kick the ball a lot more. We had 2 kicks for every handball. Our kick-to-handball ratio was 2.08, which was better than anything that we did last year. 1.47 against St Kilda was our highest this season. And last year our peak was 1.91, and then we only had the other two games over 1.7. So it was a really something out of the box to see us kick, you know, two times more than we handballed, which was really impressive. I think the introduction of Davey was important. He added some extra pace. That pace helps you defensively and put pressure on, but it also helps you to create, you know, pockets of space because he draws a little bit of a crowd and other players can fall in behind. So he added some really important, you know, dynamics to our forward half, but also spread the load. You know, Gresham and Menzies have been doing a lot of that on their own. Adding Davey into that really helped in that pressure regard. And then it got the likes of Jones, Stringer and Langford involved as well. We won 7 turnovers in our forward 50, which is the most in a game for us this season. It was only 2 against Port Adelaide. So, you know, we gave ourselves effectively 5 extra chances to hit the scoreboard by through pressure and turning the ball over in our own forward 50. And then there was another player who I think played an important part of that, but we'll touch on that in a sec. And then just to sort of close on that one, the Dogs moved the ball from their defensive 50 to forward 50 9 times. That's the least we've conceded. So that coast-to-coast measure that we wanted to get better at, 9, is bang on the AFL average. So it's not elite by any standard, but given where we've come from and even what we've seen at times earlier this year, it's a big improvement. Although it must be said, because of our ball movement being so much more considered, and let's be honest, we just took what the Bulldogs gave us. We only went inside 50 the 49 times. So we also, you know, didn't give the Bulldogs a lot of chances to rebound.
Yeah, and I guess thinking about the other end of the ground, how did you see our defensive matchups play out? So if you considered the big threats that the Dogs had with Ugglehagen, Norton, Darcy and Waitman, it was really only Ugglehagen that got away from us, and we were somewhat fortunate that he didn't kick straight. The game could have been different if he converts a couple more of those shots. In particular, it was highlighted at the start of the game that Mason Redmond was given a literally huge task by manning up on Sam Darcy, giving up almost 20 centimetres there. Obviously, that was a big risk, but what was the reward from having a matchup like that?
Yeah, I mean, their key forwards still kick 6 goals, 8 between them. So, you know, 14 shots at goal. And I think from memory, there's probably a couple out in the full amongst that. But we didn't concede too many gimme shots. Most of those were you know, lower percentage chances. So all in all, I think that was a really good sign. The risk, though, in playing Redmond was that playing Redmond on Darcy was that the Dogs could look to isolate Darcy on Redmond in one-on-one situations. But the pressure on the ground really helped to reduce that risk. There weren't too many times where Mason Redmond was caught out in a direct one-on-one, which was a big tick to what was happening up the ground. And part of that was the player that I sort of hinted towards earlier, and that was Nick Cox. We prioritised moving him into the role he's been playing earlier this season in that wing role, rotating to halfback, but playing on a smaller player, not a tall, like we saw against Port Adelaide out of necessity. We could go to town on analysing the game that Nick Cox played, but I'd encourage everyone or those that are listening that are on Twitter to have a look at the analysis that Josh put together on the game and the role Nick Cox played. He goes under the handle tball_24. Really great grabs and screenshots and videos of the influence that Nick Cox had. And he's starting to have a real impact in disrupting the opposition's ball movement through his positioning. We commented after the St Kilda game that he did a lot to really slow St Kilda down in the last quarter. The other thing that he did really effectively was he took the Darcy matchup when Darcy came up the ground. So when they were looking for a get-out kick, it wasn't Redmond on Darcy. It was often Cox on Darcy, and he was able to help compete in the air. And then that allowed Redmond to sit back and be the interceptor in our back 50. You know, Mason Redmond's had a quiet start to the year, but he had a much better game on Friday night. He had a season high 10 intercepts to the match, and that was largely due to the work that Cox was doing on the wing and allowing Redmond to play that role when the ball was in transition. The other move we made was an obvious one, and that was to send Jake Kelly back. He did a great job on Waitman. That's his bread and butter. He's a lockdown defender, and he played that role really well, and it just meant McGrath had some protection in his more aggressive role. So we sort of, you know, we had a situation where we've got some trust in Mackay defensively. We've got trust in Kelly defensively. And then it just allowed the others to use their assets, and it worked really well for us.
Yeah, definitely. And I did find it ironic that I spent all that time last week defending Jake Kelly on the wing, and they moved him back. But he did such a good job. And I think if you seeing the Bulldogs game at the moment, which I just checked the score of, that Waitman's already kicked 3 goals in the first quarter. So the fact that Kelly was able to lock him out of the game was really important to our success there. And finally, before we wrap up with the Dogs game, and we've touched on him over the last couple of weeks, but given you're the founding member of the Harry Jones fan club back in 2021, and you have the tweet to prove it, I think you should have the opportunity to comment on another strong performance from him.
Yeah, before I do that, the role that Kelly did on Waitman, they even went to the lengths of moving Waitman up to the wing in the third quarter just to try and get him involved in the game, because he was being worn so well. So yeah, real credit to Jake there. Yeah, on Jones, look, it's good to see him back up 3 weeks in a row. It was another big game from him on Friday night. It's going to be another big game that we'll need from him this week against the Crows. He's always had the attributes. He's getting more and more competitive in the air now, bringing the ball to ground when he's not winning it. He's always been a good contested mark for his age and size, but what he wasn't doing was bringing the ball to ground when he wasn't marking it, and we're seeing that happen now. Only Ben McKay had more spoils for us than Jones did, which, you know, says something about his willingness to halve contests and get the ball to ground. So yeah, really, really pleased for Harry, and yeah, hopefully he keeps going from here. I think, you know, Brad Scott gets criticism for not backing in young players, and look, that mainly comes from the, you know, the 18 or 19 North Melbourne fans that are out there. But he backed them in on Friday night. Jones was our, you know, he brought Jones back into the side in round 3 and backed him in. And, you know, he's basically playing a bit of an old-school centre-half forward role, getting up the ground, really important role in our structure and really important link man in our transition. Durham and Caldwell obviously took the responsibility for, you know, the two best Western Bulldogs mids and arguably their greatest ever player in Bontepelli. Martin's been given the responsibility to be the key in our ball movement from half-back. He packed in Davey to play a full game. He backed Cox in to play a key role in our structural set up. So, you know, there's plenty of younger players there that are getting lots and lots of opportunity and lots of responsibility to not just play and get minutes, but play really important roles in our side. I think we both lamented the performance in the coaches' box against Port Adelaide, both the coaches and the players. But I think, yeah, credit to the coaches. I thought they had a really good week last week, and they certainly outperformed Luke Beveridge and his team.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, let's move off the Dogs game and sort of hit on what's been happening during the week. And look, as the way it is with AFL media these days, the talk during the week is focused heavily on the losers, so not so much in the way of things to dissect from a Bombers perspective. That said, there were a couple of whispers around potential contracts with some big-name Essendon players who are in the final years of their current deals. So firstly, Andy McGrath has come to his free agency year. There's been no signs or rumblings that he's looking to play anywhere else, but the current talk, most recently on Cal Toomey's Gettable on AFL.com, is that they're looking at a 6-year deal for him. I know there's people that still balk at the length of the contracts that some of the players are getting, but I think we have to accept we're currently in a new paradigm of player deals, and this is what you have to do to keep the best players. McGrath also doesn't strike me as the type that's going to push for maximum dollars at the expense of club success. So even if it is for 6 years, I expect it'll be for a reasonable amount that doesn't affect our ability to pay younger players going forward or attract big trades or free agents.
There were some rumblings from other clubs that were keeping tabs on him, you know, a month or so ago, and I did hear a little bit about that they were keen to see what was happening. So I'm not sure that it's completely the case that there hasn't been, you know, interest from other clubs. I think there'd be a lot of clubs that would be asking the question of where he's at, particularly given it's a free agent and you don't need to trade, you know, like we did with the likes of McKay and Goldstein and Gresham bringing them in. On face value, mate, 6 years does seem like a lot. Longer term deals, as you touched on, they're becoming more and more common, but there's a lot of information that we don't have here, so I think we'd only be speculating and adding fuel to a fire. You know, it could be a situation where it's 5 years worth of money over 6 years, you know, give the player the extra tenure, save some bank in the salary cap to be able to manage that over a longer period of time and allow us to bring other players into the club. We'd only be speculating, but from my perspective, he's our vice captain. I think he's a good player. I think he's important. He's obviously liked by Brad Scott and the coaching group, and that's the reason he is the vice captain in the first place. You would hope that this just is pretty straightforward. We get it locked in, get him locked away, and then we just move on to the next deal. So yeah, I think we just wait and see how it plays out, mate.
Yeah, agreed. And the other contract news was that currently Jake Stringer is seeking a 3-year deal. That was in the Herald Sun yesterday. And that's what he signed with the Bombers in 2021, which has taken him to the current year. He'll turn 30 on Anzac Day. What do you see as a good deal from the club's perspective when it comes to Jake Stringer?
Honestly, I'd wait. He's on record. He did that interview with Tim Watson earlier in the year and said he wants to stay at Essendon. He sees himself as a Bombers player for life and doesn't want to go anywhere else. I'm sure the club wants to keep him as well. But I think, you know, he should just concentrate on playing good footy and keep up the performances that we've seen from him over the start of this season. I think it will probably need to be more than 1 year to get the deal done, because I've got no doubt that other clubs would offer too. If you're a team like, you know, Melbourne, who's in the hunt for the flag, even the Pies, who, you know, are struggling for some quality in their forward line, you know, a player like Drake Stringer would slot into those sides pretty well, I think. So I think a top end team would be prepared to offer him 2 years to keep him. So I don't think we're going to get away with just one year deal. But yeah, I'd just wait until closer to the end of the season and see where he's at and see how his body's holding up and make some decisions from there.
Yeah, clubs are on the lookout more for this sort of talent, to just sort of keep them up there and keep challenging. Collingwood did come out and say that that's going to be their approach over the next few years, trying to get as much as they can out of their current list and just top up to keep up and competitive there. I think, you know, I think he is someone that we want to keep. No one else does what he does for us, and I don't think we should pay any price, but I expect with the negotiations, we'll probably end up with something like a 2-year deal with some reasonable triggers for a third year, depending on his professionalism and performance over the first 2 years of the deal. And I think if that's what it comes out to, that'll be a fair outcome for both parties.
Yeah, I agree, mate.
Well, let's turn our attention to our opponents for this week in the Crows. And looking back at last year, Adelaide finished in 10th spot and were arguably a poor umpiring decision away from making the finals for the first time since their last grand final appearance in 2017. Across the season, they had 11 wins, 12 losses, and a percentage of 116.8. They were the number one offense in the competition in terms of scores for and the ninth best defense, although their performance did differ whether they were playing at home or away, with 9 of their 11 wins coming at the Adelaide Oval. So based off that and their controversial end to last season, many had Adelaide as one of the teams poised to make the jump into the eight. However, their start of the season has been below expectation. They lost the opening four games, so against the Suns and Fremantle away and to Geelong and Melbourne at home, before finally breaking their duck with a 2-point win against Carlton at Marvel. So currently this year, especially compared to last year, they have a percentage of 81.8, so a big drop, ranked 16th for scores for and 9th for scores against, although again, that's early in the season.
Yeah, there was a lot of hype about the Crows coming into this season, wasn't there? 9 of their 11 wins last year came at the Adelaide Oval, where thanks to Gather Round and two showdowns, they played 13 games for the season. They only won twice away from home. They just beat the Hawks by 3 points down in Tassie, and then they beat West Coast over in Perth, which, you know, you would expect you would expect them to have done. So, I didn't quite buy into the hype. They're certainly a great team to watch, but I wasn't pinning my hopes on them really bouncing like some others were. They're a young team. They got a lot out of their experienced players last year. Jordan Dawson won their best and fairest. And, you know, he is their best player and he's still got a lot of footy ahead of him. But then their second and third place getters were guys that are really nearing the end. Rory Laird was second and Taylor Walker had his best ever season. I think he's only All-Australian gong. And he finished third in their BNF. So to sort of get those performances from their senior players, I had a question mark on how they might back up this year, because I think that's the two dynamics, isn't it? Both young players and guys at the end of their career both have a tendency to be inconsistent. So I'm not too surprised that we've seen some inconsistency out of the Crows early in 2024.
Yeah. Well, look, comparing some of their stats from last year to this year, in 2023, the Crows kicked the ball 1.52 times for every handball, and that was the fifth best ratio in the comp. So they've actually increased their ratio so far this year to 1.56, although that's actually now only the ninth best mark. So it's really indicating that at least at the start of the season, the competition has really shifted to much more of a kicking game so far this year. The teams are kicking far more compared to handballing than in the previous year. Both this year and last year, they've been plus two for inside 50s. However, they have had a drastic drop in inside 50 efficiency. So as you would imagine from being the best scoring side in the comp, they also had the best efficiency last year with 53% of their inside 50s entries last year ending in a score. But they've dropped to the third worst this year with only 40%, and that's just ahead of Hawthorne and North Melbourne so far this year. So really poor efficiency going inside 50 from the Crows so far this year.
Yeah, they're having 1.6 fewer inside 50s a game so far this season, which doesn't sound a lot, but, you know, footy can be a game of small margins. So they're averaging 53.2 per game to be ranked 8th in the AFL. For context, we're ranked 12th with 50.4. They're also conceding 0.7 fewer per game. So, you know, arguably the defensive parts of their game are working as well, if not a little bit better than last year, to be ranked 3rd in the AFL with 51.2 per game. We're ranked 15th, conceding 56, but it should be said that in our wins, that comes down to 52, so not too far away from where the Crows are at. So if you're sort of prepared to, you know, take the Port Adelaide game, our Port Adelaide game is a bit of an aberration, and, you know, respect the fact that we played a really, really good Swans game. When we get our game plan going, we're certainly showing that it you know, sort of stands up to a team that's, you know, one of the better sides at it.
Yeah, I think also part of the reason why they've dropped off a bit is that they were going a lot slower. Teams were able to force them wide and you know, slow their ball movement down. And when they were going inside 50, they were coming in from a wide angle, which is a lot easier to cut off. I know that they injected Rankin into the middle last week, and that created some spark and speed. And that's part of the reason why they were able to get notch their first win last week. And you imagine they would be doing something similar this week. So you imagine there might be some changes in the way they're playing compared to what's come previously. But if you look at some of the other data points, they've improved their center clearance work. They had a slight negative differential last year to plus two, and that's the fifth best in the comp. However, their stoppage work has gone the other way. They were breaking even in 2023, and they're down three in 2024, and that's the second worst in the comp in terms of stoppage differential. And then in 2023, no side had a better marks inside 50 differential. They took 3.73 more than their opponents. But so far in 2024, they have been going at minus eight, which is ranked 11th. So they're not taking as many marks, and they're allowing a lot more than they were in last year, again, when they were, you know, the best offensive side in the comp. And again, not being able to take marks inside 50 has cost them scoring shots. Their intercept game has also collapsed. They actually had the second best differential in the comp in 2023, so the second worst in 2024. So they're giving up the ball a lot more there. So a lot of things breaking down in their game, but again, early in the season, and teams can turn this sort of thing around and go on a run. So it's not something we should be sleeping lightly on.
No, definitely not. And one thing they have still been pretty good at is they're fifth in the AFL for conceding the fewest number of marks in the comp. So they're opposition teams are averaging 87 marks a game against them. It's going to be interesting to see what they try and do to take that away from us. I'm sure they'll have some plans. We had 107 marks against them in our win against them last year. So, and, you know, we spoke just earlier about how it's a bit of a KPI, 100 plus, and we tend to give ourselves a chance to win. So I'm sure that'll be something that they'll be watching really closely. But speaking of last year, mate, what changes have the Crows made list-wise?
Yeah, so they made one of the lower number of changes of any list, and particularly the ones we've come up with. They had eight players depart and only five players join. In terms of the departures, Tom Duday departed as a free agent to Brisbane. He played 11 games last year before suffering a season-ending knee injury, and unfortunately for him, he's also suffered another one when he's got up to Brisbane there. Shane McAdam was traded to Melbourne, having featured in seven games, whilst Paul Seisman retired for concussion reasons, having not featured in 2023. Another player, Fisher McCasey, retired at the beginning of 2023 as well. Whilst four others we did listed, with only two of those, Tyler Brown and Jackson Hatley, both only playing one game for the year. And Jackson Hatley obviously has joined Essendon VFL and done pretty well for himself so far, and is really pushing for a mid-season draft spot at any club, let alone Essendon. The Crows only brought in one player from another club, with Chris Burgess joining in a trade from the Suns. He played in the opening four rounds of the year, but didn't play last week and hasn't come back in for this week. And three others came in through the draft, with the Crows trading up to get access to Daniel Curtin at pick eight. But none of their draft picks are featured this year. There was talk that Curtin had been performing well in the sandful, but he hasn't come in, and neither has their new Cat B rookie. So a really stagnant list from last year, and they were hoping to get that general improvement from their younger players to really push them this year.
Yeah, I guess their list strategy would have been to keep building upon what they already had, given, you know, they would have felt that they did a lot right last year and would have had some, expect to get some natural improvement out of the young players, which I'm sure they still will. And then Burgess coming in just gave them some key forward, you know, backup and security. We briefly touched on our match against them last year. It was probably the final real highlight for Dons fans in 2023. Just take us for a walk down memory lane just quickly, mate.
Yeah, so back in round 17 of last year, Essendon 17-13, 115, defeated Adelaide 15-7, 97. It was a sixth victory in a row against the Crows, and it was a high-scoring affair. 12 goals were kicked in the first quarter, but look, Essendon took the early lead and never relinquished it. They got out to a 42-point margin early in the fourth before the Crows kicked some late goals to reduce the margin to 18 points at the close. The Dons played a really high possession game, 196 handballs, and the ratio of 1.16 kicks to handballs was their lowest mark of the season, and they had 90 more uncontested possessions. You already touched on the fact that we took a lot more marks against them in the game last year as well. We really controlled the ball there, and we were able to turn that into scoreboard pressure. The clearances were even, although unlike how we usually do against sides in previously, we were able to intercept the ball a lot more often than our opponents. We went a plus six for the match. Between the two of them, Darcy Parrish and Zach Merritt had a monstrous 39 disposals each, with Parrish also having eight clearances and Merritt having 650 metres gained. It was a real spread of goal kickers. Peter Wright and Kyle Langford both kicked three, while Menzie, Guelphy and Munn kicked two each. Looking at the Crows, Rory Laird had 31 and Jordan Dawson with 29 were their disposal leaders, whilst Walker, Rankin, Pedler and Keys each kicked two.
Yeah, it was probably the first time that we saw the Essendon press, what we've been seeing this year, really stand up to a team in good form and really took away some of the dynamic attributes of the Adelaide Crows and put the pressure right on them. We had 58 inside 50s for the game. To that point in the season, that was the third most that the Crows had conceded, and we kept them to just 53. So, you know, a minus or a plus five inside 50 differential was a bit of a rarity for us last year. So, it was a really high pressure game from us, and we got the rewards for that on the scoreboard. Let's move on to 2024, though, mate. What's happened at the selection table?
Yeah, so pretty straightforward selection this week. Jai Menzie suffered a bit of a shoulder injury and is out for a couple of weeks, and he's gone out of the side, and in's come Elijah Sardis, with Archie Roberts, Nate Caddy and Jaden Davey all listed as the emergencies there. Injured player goes out, one player comes in. They've kept a winning side together. And given the fact that Brad Scott's talked about Nick Hind getting a full game, you imagine that Sardis coming in, he'll be the sub, so Hind can have that full game time just to make sure that he's all good in terms of his metrics and his running numbers. Luckily for us, our VFL game is Saturday at 11:40, so all our travelling emergencies should be able to get back for a full game, and then maybe even Sardis might play some extra time in the VFL if he doesn't get on the park very much in the AFL. I did find interesting that Shield wasn't named as an emergency, and also the fact that they're prepared to play Jaden Davey if required as well, named in the emergencies, so there's no guarantee that him being named in the emergencies will mean that he travels with the side.
Yeah, I guess the thing that we'll need to think about when it comes to the emergencies and Dylan Shield playing in the VFL is that we play Thursday next week. So it is a short turnaround for anyone that does play VFL. And then, you know, that probably puts a little bit of concern on Sardis as well, as if he is the sub. And I think you're right, given Hind's been sub, 3 weeks in a row now, you'd probably need to get a full game into him. But Sardis only played half a game in the VFL last week. If he only plays a quarter or a bit more this week, then he'd be lacking some match fitness or some game time as well. So yeah, a delicate one to manage. But yeah, Menzie, shame for him. He wasn't in the form that we would have liked. He got moved up to the wing. I thought his pressure and influence in the air when needed was really good, but wasn't able to get his hands on the ball a lot. So it's a bit of a shame that he wasn't able to go back to the VFL and get some form, because he needed to get some touch, but hopefully he recovers quickly. Certainly shows what a tough player he is to play out the game or you know, the rest of his time on the ground with that shoulder injury. But yeah, I think you're right, man. I think Sardis is probably the sub. Hines slots into that sort of, Hines and Davies slot into that half forward wing rotation that Menzies played last week. And yeah, it's pretty much like for like. And then we get to inject Sardis's pace and carry it some point during the game. We saw he come on at halftime against Hawthorn and have a real impact in the second half. So yeah, I like the fact that we've kept the speed in the 23 that we already had, and we're adding some more of it through Elijah Sardis.
Yeah. And looking at the Crows, that they've made two forced changes there. The out's gone Jordan Butts, who's injured, and Matt Crouch with a suspension there. And in comes James Borlase and Lachlan Scholl. Butts is one of their key defenders, and they've replaced him with Borlase, and Borlase is 6 centimetres shorter, much more of a sort of intercepting player. I suspect they probably feel they can get away with a shorter back line against us, given the absence of Peter Wright, although lacking that another tall defender might make it a bit easier for a player like Draper to have an impact in the forward line.
Yeah, I'm not sure they're blessed with choice at the moment. They do have some injuries in that part of the ground, so I guess it's as like for like as they could probably muster with what they've got available. Although Elliot Himmelberg, I guess, is potentially an option for them. He was one of their emergencies, but they've left him out. So it's an opportunity for us to be able to stretch them.
Yeah, it's an interesting one with Himmelberg. He wanted to go to the GWS last year, and Adelaide held him to his contract, and yet they're not playing him. So interesting behind-the-scenes stuff there, but we're not a Crows podcast. We're an Essendon podcast, so that's for if you're really interested in the background there, I'm sure there's some Crows podcasts you can listen to if you're that desperate to find out about the Himmelberg news. Let's look at Adelaide's last game. You know, they got their first win of the season, defeating Carlton 16-4-100 to Carlton's 14-14-98. So obviously Adelaide were very much more accurate than the Blues, and they actually came back from 15 points down midway through the final quarter to snatch victory. So it was their ability to be efficient in front of goal, getting them over the line. They took 9 more marks inside 50 than their opponents, despite having 3 less entries. And they scored 9 goals, 1 from intercept compared to the Blues, 6 goals, 8. And that was 11-point difference, and probably the difference in the end, their ability to score from intercept. Jake Soligo and Matt Crouch led the way. They both had 27 disposals and 6 clearances. And Taylor Walker, as you hinted before, you know, had been a little bit poor to start the year, but he was back to his best with 4 goals.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't feel sorry for them, but it's a game that Carlton will be kicking themselves for letting slip. I think they would have felt that they did enough right, apart from their finishing in front of goal, to get the 4 points. But yeah, as I said, I certainly, you know, I don't even go to the museum because it's in Carlton, mate, so I'm not going to feel upset that they lost the game. But yeah, they had more inside 50s for the game. They had more clearances. They had more contested balls. So, you know, a lot of the core metrics they were ahead in. Adelaide were just, yeah, so much more efficient in front of goal and made the most of their chances. And to be honest, Carlton really dropped off in the last quarter and went to sleep a little bit late in the game and you know, made it easier than it should have been for the Crows to hit the scoreboard in the last quarter.
Yeah. Well, look, turning to our match against them tomorrow night, we're recording on the Thursday night, and one of the problems that Adelaide had prior to this week was that their midfield was very one-paced, and probably the one major point of difference in Jordan Dawson and his ball movement was down on form. So against Carlton, we touched on this before, but they ran Rankin through the midfield to provide a lot of that spark, and he's a different challenge to the rest of their midfielders. And as we touched on earlier, they've also been an effective centre clearance side, but not so much in the stoppage area. So I guess, you know, you imagine that Rankin is going back through that midfield, given that that was one of the reasons why they were able to get up against Carlton the week before. Do we back ourselves to run head-to-head with their mids, or do we need to put time into him, for example? And do we have a player that's suited to playing on him?
Yeah, we saw Isaac Rankin for the first time really play as almost a full-time midfielder last week. He only attended 11 centre bounces in 2023. He's always been a player that, well, certainly as a Crows player, has got up the ground and got around stoppages anyway, you know, playing as a, you know, high half forward, running back into 50. But if we use the centre bounce as a bit of a reference point as a starting mid, yeah, he only went into 11 centre bounces for the entirety of 2023. In the first 4 rounds of this season, that it up. So he attended 21 in total across the first 4 weeks. So, you know, already double what he did all of last year. And then against Carlton last week, he attended 20 you know, for the game. So, you know, double that, almost double that again. He had 23 disposals, 11 contested possessions, 9 score involvements and 3 goals. So it was a really high impact game. Overall, though, Carlton outscored the Crows 49-26 from stoppages. And I do think that's a part of the game that we would be hoping we can get some real ascendancy. So despite, you know, the Crows winning the game, it was part of the game that the Crows were soundly beaten. Rankin has some real toe, some speed, acceleration that the Dogs mids last week didn't have. Dawson, you know, you touched on him. He's the other one that we need to keep an eye on. He can really, you know, he's been down this season, but he's their most prolific going inside 50. And if you give him time on the ball, he can really cut you up by foot. I think Caldwell and Durham both showed last week that they can mix defense and attack. They can mind the dangerous opposition midfielder and win their own footy and pick and choose the right time to defend first versus attack first. I'd be going with a similar setup to last week and using those two as our more defensive-minded midfielders. And, you know, I'd continue to do what we did last week with Jake Stringer as well and just send him in once or twice a quarter to give the opposition something else to look at, something else to be mindful of, give ourselves a little bit of, you know, power in there as well, and then, you know, continue to run back in Parrish and Merritt to do their thing. So, yeah, I think it's a bit of same-same and challenge our mids to, you know, not just pat themselves on the back and be accepting of one good performance is enough in modern AFL football. Here's your opportunity to back it up against, you know, some quality players once again.
Yeah, I think we showed last year that Dawson is someone you can have an impact on if you watch him closely. I remember Archie Perkins played on him last year and it forced them to move Dawson to halfback. Perkins was doing such a good job. So it is something that we've shown we're capable of, obviously. Archie's not playing this week, but we've got the sort of players you mentioned there who can do that job and limit their ability to move the ball there. And again, you know, touching on what works for us, the game style that has worked best for us is, you know, relied on locking the ball into our forward half. And I guess you don't really think too much about the Crows in terms of having strong movers from half back. Who do we need to limit their ability to exit from our forward 50 to give ourselves the best chance of locking that ball in there and getting repeat shots on goal?
Yeah, we spoke about this after the Hawthorn game, didn't we, with the role that Guelphy did on Sicily. So if you go and Guelphy did a great job on Sicily in that game and had a huge contribution. But the risk in locking down and minding an opposition defender is that you take a player out of your own setup and structure. Forward half pressure, or, you know, locking the ball in your forward half needs to be a whole team thing. And that's the risk that you have in locking down is you're taking a player out of your setup or out of your structure. And it can create holes. Hinge and Smith are the two that drive a lot of their play from half back. Hinge has had the fourth most inside 50s of the Crows this season. Smith is equal sixth, and they score 40% of the time that Smith goes inside 50s, which is the best conversion at the club. So, you know, we don't want to allow those guys to get up the ground and be able to influence going inside 50. I thought Ben Hobbs had his best game for us last week. He's had games where he's won more of the ball. He's won, you know, clearances and contested possession. But I thought his discipline and concentration was the best that it's been. He appeared to put some time into Jason Johannesson as well. So I think he'll have another important role to play this week. And then having some speed in the game with Gresham, Davey, Hind, and then Sardis when, you know, we predict he'll be sub when he comes on, I think is really going to help in that regard as well. So, yeah, I think it's about what the team does, mate, rather than I wouldn't be sending individuals to go and lock down on any of their sort of key ball movers. I think it's a whole of field approach. And that's working for us. We're number two in the competition for winning turnovers inside forward 50. So we have the tools and we've demonstrated that we can really disrupt them and take that away from their game.
Yeah. And you mentioned Brody Smith there. He's got under a bit of an injury cloud with some back soreness. So it'll be interesting to see if he's able to get up and then how effective he'll be on game day if he does play. And then I managed to get to Gather Round, which I've spoken about a couple of times, and I saw their game against Melbourne. And what really struck me was just how well Melbourne were able to slow them down, slow their forward 50 injuries, and just how much they struggled to get shots on goal when they were going in slowly. You know, some teams like a Geelong, you know, can have that slow ball and then get shots on goal, even if they have got that slow ball movement. But it does seem that Adelaide really relies on that quick ball movement. So how can we make sure that we do slow down their forward 50 entries and prevent them from getting those easy shots on goal?
Yeah, I think the first thing is is making them take the longest path to their goal as often as possible. So, you know, that means winning clearance, taking territory, deep entries and slowing the exit. So that forward half game that we want to play, that's the, you know, the best medicine to prevent their, you know, them getting fast ball movement and their forwards getting on top. They don't have an overly tall forward line. Tex Walker and Darcy Fogarty are their two key forwards. Darcy Fogarty would be, without looking it up, I expect sort of 192, 193 centimetres. He's not a, you know, 194 maybe. He's not a 200 centimetre, you know, the likes of what we saw last week with Darcy, et cetera. So yeah, it's not overly tall. Lachlan Gollant was drafted as a tall midfielder at 191 centimetres. He was their relief ruckman last week, and I expect that'll be the case again this week, and we'll see him play some time forward. So, yeah, I think pressure on the ball is a number one priority, because doing that allows us to then set up and get numbers behind the ball. And then priority number two is Nick Cox and our rucks setting up in our defensive structure to interrupt and slow down their ball movement. Riley O'Brien's a really good ruckman, probably a little bit underrated in you know, most circles. He's not necessarily talked about a lot when people talk about the premier ruckman, but he'll be doing a lone job. So our rucks getting forward on him and really making him run hard and ideally having him want to conserve energy by not pushing forward himself is going to be important. But that also allows one of our rucks to go and set up and get in front of the likes of Tex and Fogarty and ask questions of the Crows forwards when they're moving in or when they're going inside 50, and then locking down on their smalls with a Kelly, I think, you know, becomes really important. So we can just shut at least one of them out and make it difficult for the others. So yeah, priority number one, mate, is that pressure on the ball. Priority number two is Cox and our rucks being able to set up defensively to interrupt and slow down their ball movement.
And finally, flipping the script and putting on your Crows coach hat, who's Matthew Nix most worried about when it comes to the Bombers? Who can really take the game away from them coming into Friday night?
Yeah, I mean, as we just touched on, through some injury, they're down on some defenders. I think they'll worry about the spread of goal kickers we had last week. We had 10 goal kickers. And, you know, and I think we had something similar against them last year as well. So, yeah, I think all the things that we just spoke about wanting to do to them, pressure on the ball, winning clearance, how important they are to our chances, then they'll be wanting to do the same to limit, you know, and protect their back six, because they'll know if we do get on top in those areas, then we can really expose them and do some damage. In the last 3 weeks, they've conceded a score 54% of the time their opposition has gone inside 50. On the flip side, we've conceded a score 47.5% of the time over the last 3 weeks, which is a big improvement on 2023. So our back six is starting to get some improved resilience, and that's despite the pounding we copped against Port Adelaide, and their back six has been exposed. So I think if we can separate and create one-on-ones, and that's something that we have been pretty good at doing, that will make Nix and his coaching staff pretty nervous. The Crows have got three of the top 10 or bottom 10, I guess, for the top 10 worst defensive one-on-one losses per game this season. Will Hamill has the third most in the AFL. Jordan Butts, who's out this week injured, is ninth. And then Borlase, who they've brought in to replace him, is 10th. So I think we have the tools and the weapons up forward to really do some damage in one-on-one contests. And if they can get some separation, and that comes if we can win clearance and win territory.
Yeah, well, let's see how that plays out on Friday night. Let's turn to our final thoughts, and I've actually outsourced the final thoughts work this week, and I've been struggling to come up with interesting ones, and so I've taken this one from one of our patrons, Andrew. So thanks to Andrew for helping out. And his final thought was, you know, each week he's finished the game with a different emotion. So round one, he was content with the win over the Hawks. Round two was proud of the effort against the Swans. Round three was excited after beating the Saints. Round four, frustrated after the shellacking against Port. And then round five, really pumped following our efforts against the Bulldogs. So for our final thought, what will Andrew's emotion be at the end of our game against Adelaide?
Yeah, I watched the game with Andrew last week. I can certainly attest to how pumped he was. I think all of those emotions will be there this week, sadly. The Crows have some real similarities with us in how they go about things and how we like to go about things. You know, similar age profile and experience profile. So I think this will be a game where all of the emotions will come out of us. There'll be some seesawing momentum, and therefore I think there'll be some seesawing of emotions. I'll settle for the round one emotion at the end, I think, mate. If we're content at the end, then I think that'll be a good result for us.
Yeah, I'll be happy with that as well. Well, look, that'll do us for tonight. Thanks again for all your work this week, Jono, especially in recording the medical room with episode with Pat. Once again, check out the link in the description of this episode for tickets to the live show. They're going to go quick, so get in early. There's a lot of things being worked in behind the scenes, and we're looking at getting some really exciting guests and other things to come in through the live show. So as I said, get in early, make sure you save yourself a spot there. Any final words from you, Jono?
Yes, thanks to you too, mate, for all the work you do and keeping this show going and organized. I wouldn't be able to do it without you, that's for sure. Please check out the medical room episode on our Patreon. Pat did a great job. Really took the time to explain some of these injuries and what's going on and what rehab might look like. There is a 7-day free trial available, so you can try out and have listen before you buy. Get on board. It's been lots of fun to put that together. Can't wait for the live show, mate. But before that, can't wait to see how we go on Friday night.
Well said, mate. Stay safe, everyone, and go Dons.